This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Tank Sinatra.
And I'm Investigator Slater.
And together we co-host a podcast called Psychopedia, which is a true crime podcast infused with comedy, making it a crimedy. Each week, Investigator Slater brings us a wild and thoroughly researched true crime case. I'm here to digest it all and react just like you probably are right there on the other side of the microphone.
Somehow, I've got to present each case with the detail and respect it deserves, while also cracking up at Tank's perfectly timed humor and thought-provoking questions.
Listen to and follow Psychopedia on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Betwixt and between a front here, a little bit of drizzle remaining, but that's going to clear up later on. And then highs today of 71 as one front comes through, and that's going to be later on this afternoon. Then highs tomorrow of 78, so we're near 80 tomorrow, Thanksgiving. About a 50% chance for showers. I don't know if they're quite sure on the timing of the front yet, but it's going to get a lot cooler after that. I would dare say cold highs Friday, Black Friday, of only 59, 60 Saturday, 59 on Sunday. But wait, highs Monday of only 54 and lows Sunday night, Monday morning in the upper 30s, lower 40s. So not in time for Thanksgiving, but in time for December, we're getting some cool weather. Aaron Dusso joins us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the way the numbers turned out, the tally in the House and in the Senate. It's one thing to win an election. It's another to govern, right?
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you have as tight a majority in the House as they're going to have, you have little leeway to let people, members in purple districts kind of vote based on their district rather than the party.
So say that part again.
So, I mean, normally if you had, say, a 15 or 20 seat majority, what you're going to elect those members that are in those tight districts, the purple districts, you're going to let them vote against the party sometimes just because you want them to win re-election, and so that helps them. But when you've only got one or two seats, you can't let them do that, and so they're going to have a much more conservative voting record.
I want you to say that again because it goes sometimes to the show business of politics where, okay, we're going to give you a pass on this one. You're going to have to vote no, even though you would want to vote yes because of your district. You understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Right, yeah. I mean, this is it is a part of a show because when you run for re-election, you want to be able to point to, achievements. You might want, if you're in a purple district, you want to be able to point to your more moderate stance than either, if you're a Democrat or a Republican, than the current party. And so when you have this close of a majority, you're not going to be able to do that. And so you probably are going to be a little bit harmed, come 2 years from now when you're running for re-election.
So let's talk about party loyalty. Well, first off, let's talk about numbers. The final total, as I understand it, 221, 214?
Right, yeah. So I think they call those last three districts just the last couple of days. But so, yeah, you're talking 218 is the majority. So you have a three-seat majority. This is tiny.
So given the fact that Donald Trump is president and loyalty is valued beyond all else, it would seem like, does every Republican immediately jump in line no matter what the issue is? And that goes to what you were talking about before, because of loyalty. And if the president says yes, if the president says sit, you don't look for a chair, you just sit down?
I think that's what the president certainly wants. And I think that's what's going to end up being the leadership in the House is going to have to force that kind of compliance because they just can't afford to lose anyone. So, these last couple of districts that were, called, it's going to, you might want to have a more moderate voting record, but you're just not going to be allowed to do it.
So when it comes to the Marjorie Taylor Greens, let me take a step back again with Matt Gaetz. Have they determined whether or not he resigned his seat in the previous Congress or in this one?
my understanding is that he resigned in the last Congress, and so you have this open seat. And he's not going to—he theoretically could take that seat again because he won it, in January. But he said he's not going to, so that's going to be left open.
So what does that mean? They have another that somebody's appointed?
Right. Right. So likely it'll be an appointment until they can have a special election in Florida for that seat.
So when it comes to the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the I'm trying to think of some other real Trump partisans led to the former speaker being ousted. Now you got Mike Johnson from Louisiana. You got Steve Scalise from Louisiana, the majority leader, the majority whip, I guess. What is Steve's title? I got confused here. The speaker would be Kevin. No, the speaker would be Mike Johnson, right, Professor?
Right, and right, Steve right. Scalise, yeah. Speaker, I think, is majority leader.
The leader, not the whip, because the whip is beneath the leader, right?
Right. Yeah.
Majority leader. Yeah. So those are two pretty powerful positions for two guys from Louisiana, a relatively, I guess, weak politically state nationally to have. But they are very, very loyal and attached at the hip to Donald Trump. Do these two guys stay in position?
I think they're going to stay attached to Donald Trump because ultimately the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world are going to take their marching orders from Trump. And so, I mean, what that really shows is that the president, and the House are going to work really closely together to try and accomplish the president's goals. There's not going to be an independent, I wouldn't think anyway, an independent voice in that room.
There are no independents elected to the House, right, as it stands now?
Right. Not that I've seen, no.
So with that being the case, it would seem to me like even if, and you can talk about, let me take a break. When you come back, you can talk about purple districts, if you will. And I guess that might be a situation where maybe they voted for Trump, but or maybe they voted for Harris, but they got a Republican in Congress. We'll talk about that when we come back. And it just seems to me, I don't know how any scenario could play out, given the fact that the House, for the most part, Republicans are, I'm just going to say it, terrified of getting on the wrong side of Donald Trump. First of all, if that's still a situation, does he still wield the same power that he did? And if that is the case, it would seem as though, with Mike Johnson being afraid of getting on the wrong side of a Marjorie Taylor Greene or what have you, or same with Steve Scalise, I don't mean necessarily negatively, I mean afraid politically, that maybe the president might have a rubber stamp when it comes to the House. We'll talk about it when we come back. Aaron Dusso, our guest, associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. And I'll ask you all at 504-260-1870, do you want your Republican representatives to fall in line in lockstep with whatever the president wants? Or if it's better for Louisiana, do you want them to go the other way? You can text me at 504-260-1870. Somebody texted in and said, seems like the Democrats fall in line with the party more than the Republicans do. I think that's might be, you're looking at that through a partisan prism, but we'll see what the professor thinks when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Dusso, associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. The text comes in, Trump won popular vote in electoral college. He has a clear mandate. The people have spoken. You are on the wrong side of history, and I'm sure here comes your liberal professor. Your side lost. You obviously don't understand what a clear mandate is. Educate yourself. Well, 71 million people did vote for Harris, and I don't think that they have no voice in any way that the country is run, and they do have how many Democrats in the House of Representatives? It's not always the majority wins, right, Professor?
Right. I mean, the use of the term mandate is kind of, again, this is a pop discussion. It might be important on TV, but in the end, you still got to win the votes in Washington, right? And so that's what we're talking about with regards to the really close House. And so Donald Trump needs to keep his caucus in the House in line. And he's not going to, and my guess is that he'll probably do a pretty good job of it because I think many Republicans don't want to be on the other side of his tweeting. And that's because that's a big problem for them.
So if that's the case, does he have a rubber stamp when it comes to the House?
I mean, rubber stamp, it might be a bit far, but I think he's going to, essentially make the decisions on what he wants to see. He certainly is going to consult with Johnson, Speaker of the House, about what he thinks he can get done. But in the end, it's going to be Donald Trump driving that show.
When it comes to the Senate, talk about that, if you will.
I mean, the Senate, they have a bit more leeway, 50 53 seats in the Senate, so there's a bit more options there. But still, it's really close. Ultimately, once you get over the majority, what the next step is to get a supermajority so you can avoid the filibuster, and that's what they don't have. And so in the end, whether they had 50 votes and they can use the vice president to break a tie, or they have 53, is not that big a difference there.
So what is this likely to look like the next 4 years, given the, well, at least next 2 years, I should say, until the midterms, with the makeup of the House of Representatives and the Senate?
Right. I mean, those first 2 years, you're exactly right. The first 2 years are critical, and that's where they're going to push as much and as fast as possible. And that we've seen, you know, over the last several administrations that have come in with the majority in both the House and the Senate. They do, those first 2 years are critical. But what's interesting here, and I think it's a complete unknown, is how does Donald Trump handle the Supreme Court's willingness to say the president of the United States is immune when he's doing things that are part of his core powers of the Constitution, and overseeing the federal government, you know, and particularly the executive branch of the government, and all that bureaucracy is a core power in the Constitution. And so when he, you know, receives any pushback from Congress there, really, really exert that kind of power where I can just ignore the law.
What would that look like? Give me an example of that.
Well, so the key, you know, one I'm watching right now is going to be, you know, the budget. So Congress can appropriate funds, say, for the Department of Education to do stuff. But, you know, the Office of Management and Budget is within the executive office of the president, and that's where, you know, the power might lie to impound that money. Now, there's the Impoundment Act of 1974, I think it was, which would theoretically make it against the law for the president to impound those funds for more than 45 days. But it is part of his core duties, and so does he need to follow the law in that case? And then in theory, what he could do is simply say, I can starve the Department of Education, even if I can't completely eliminate, because that require an act of Congress. I can starve it so that it doesn't have any functioning anymore. And that would essentially be breaking the law, but he's immune to any, you know, law problems. So we'll see. That's fascinating to me.
I can't imagine a Republican in the House risking the wrath of Donald Trump.
I can't either, especially this close. You know, because every time it's happened, you know, the person has found themselves on the outside, right? So Liz Cheney, she is, you know, a Republican as Republican be, and yet she's on the outside of the Republican Party now. So if it can happen to Liz Cheney, it can happen to you.
Right. That's why I just think it's going to be more like a rubber stamp, but we'll see. Thank you, Professor. Have a nice Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.
Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. We'll talk to Aaron Bendeley about tax reform and the governor's measures that went through right now. Time for WWL First News. All right, 6:44, 16 till 7. Got a little front coming through, and then it's going to clear out later on today with highs only near 70 or so. We're going to be riding a little bit of a roller coaster, I guess, if you will, because then highs today are going to be around the area of 71 degrees, 78 tomorrow, near 80 Thanksgiving, 50% chance for showers, highs of 75. Then cools off a lot for Black Friday, highs of 59 on Friday, 60 Saturday, 59 on Sunday, then Monday, mid-50s. So you'll be able to get those jackets out, coats and sweaters and everything else if you remember where you put them. Aaron Bendeley joins us now, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing great. And you?
I am okay. Let's talk about the governor's tax reform plan, what passed, what didn't, what still needs to be looked at, and from the Pelican Institute's standpoint.
Well, we're really pleased. We think it was a good outcome. The legislature adjourned a little bit early last Friday. They had been scheduled to adjourn yesterday. So they concluded their work early, and they actually got a lot done that I think will really make our state more competitive. That was the impetus for calling this session in the first place. Governor Landry announced a bold plan to bring jobs and opportunity back to our state, position us to be competitive, and most importantly, bring our kids and grandkids home. And so we're excited that the legislature did that through a number of bills, a tax package that reduced a number of taxes, made our tax code fairer, less complex, and then a big piece of that we had been pushing, which is a restraint of government spending going forward to make sure that we begin to get our fiscal house in order and bring that spending back to a level that we believe is more sustainable for our people.
What did you say, bring our kids home? Tell me what specifically is, and I'm a little bit confused about that. You said bring our kids home, and what was the other one?
I was talking about bringing our kids and grandkids home, bringing jobs and opportunity back to our state. We have lost, as a state, we've lost over 120,000 people since 2016 alone. Mm-hmm. Every year consecutively since then, we have had more people leaving our state than coming in. I have friends and family members that have moved on in search of opportunity in other states. Many of my friends and neighbors and coworkers have similar stories. And a lot of that is because other states have done more to make their states competitive, where businesses want to operate, where families want to go in search of opportunity. And we're behind. We've got a lot of ground to make up.
The reason I ask is because, you know, that's a lot of that, I think, is kind of, with all due respect, anecdotal. And I get a lot of anecdotal texts here that come in. And to a point, they say it's the insurance that's driving people away. It's not tax reform. And I'm not trying to criticize what the governor said or what you're saying. I'm just thinking you got to factor insurance into this, don't you?
Absolutely. And that's not to say that the issues addressed in this fiscal session were the only ones that need to be addressed. Certainly, we have to address rising insurance costs. We have to continue to work to make our educational system top quality so our kids are prepared when they leave the K-12 education system. A number of issues that we still need to address. Regulatory reform is another one. But this is one in particular that there was a special focus on taxes on the state budget, because these are real policies that drive business and jobs and opportunities away. And these population numbers are real people. 120,000 people from Louisiana have left our state since 2016. If you look at just the period between 2020 and 2023, 84,000 people left our state. That's roughly the size of Lake Charles. I was there this past Thursday giving a speech to a group of people in Lake Charles and said, can you imagine your entire city being gone within a 3-year period? It's alarming, and we have to take that seriously.
Now that's real. That's not anecdotal. Those numbers are real, and I'm not challenging that at all or questioning that. I'm just wondering about, is there any way to really determine the role of insurance and triage with the reason for people leaving? Have surveys been done about that?
I don't know that studies have been done specifically asking what public policies have driven people's decisions to leave. I think most families will tell you it's a number of things. It's, mm-hmm. you know, again, this is anecdotal, but I think many will point to jobs. A lot of us know of people who have just received more competitive job offers and a chance to progress their career in other states, search of education opportunity, and overall lower cost of living. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Insurance is certainly a part of that. I know in my family, we got an increase in our homeowners insurance and our car insurance this year. We're encouraged that even though the legislature took some bold steps in tax reform and spending restraint, that they will come back next year and in the subsequent sessions and tackle some of those remaining issues, because this is just a start. This is a really good start, but as you mentioned, there are still other issues that need to be tackled.
And I'm not trying to imply that this is not going to lead to economic growth or development, but I don't know that you can look at this as it's just about tax reform and people leaving, and in my opinion at least, or about job opportunity without addressing the big elephant in the room, which is the rising cost of home insurance. And again, anecdotal, but that's just from the text that I get every day. We're talking to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President of Policy and Strategy at the Pelligan Institute. We'll look at it from a positive standpoint when we come back. And we'll ask Aaron, give us some examples of how the governor's the reforms that were passed and what needs to be approved by voters, how that could lead to our kids and grandkids coming home, economic development, and what the future of the state could look like. If you got any questions, 504-260-1870-650, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 656, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelligan Institute. So let's talk about, if you will, Aaron, before we went to break, we were talking about some positive examples of how the reforms that were passed could lead to, or are there companies that have expressed interest, not quite quid pro quo, but if you do this, we'll come here. Are there expansions on the horizon for Louisiana businesses, as far as we know, because of the reforms? Tell me how the future's going to look like, if you know.
Well, throughout the session, our Secretary of Economic Development, Susan Bourgeois, testified a number of times that because of our complicated tax code and our punishing corporate taxes on business, there are a lot of times that Louisiana doesn't even get put on the radar. We're not even in the mix when it comes to major businesses that are looking to locate. We certainly want them and need them in our state to provide jobs. We are ranked right now 40th in the state for overall tax competitiveness by the Tax Foundation. So we believe that where the legislature ended up will put us on the map finally in a pretty competitive way. So just talking about the corporate taxes alone, the legislature repealed the punishing franchise tax, which is basically a tax on the privilege of doing business in our state. Most states do not have this tax, and they certainly don't have a mix of the three corporate taxes that we have had for many years, which is a franchise tax, a corporate income tax, and a corporate inventory tax. We are one of three states that does that. So again, bringing corporate income taxes down to a more competitive 5.5%, eliminating that franchise tax, and beginning the process of hopefully phasing out some of those inventory taxes, we believe that will be great relief. And all of the economic development experts and our leaders testified that this will get Louisiana in the game of where we need to be.
Somebody wants to know about keeping score. They texted in about how would we know if these reforms work or not, if you have a time frame on that.
Well, it's interesting, and a lot of people, if they keep up with their state legislators, even on Facebook, I saw a number of them posting a graphic that shows Louisiana's relative position to other states when it comes to overall tax competitiveness and what has been their population increase, positive or negative. And so that's an interesting indicator that we can continue to watch over time. Just like in the world of sports, being competitive is more than just a one action play. We have to constantly reevaluate where we stand relative to other states. Even our neighboring states have been taking actions to position themselves as places where people want to go and where businesses want to go. We have to constantly evaluate where we stand to make sure that we stay competitive.
And you got to have a good special teams guy, a gunner, but you also got to have a quarterback, right? And I guess that goes to priority. So what can be done next as far as tackling the insurance crisis? What would the Pelican Institute like to see done there?
Well, a number of lawmakers have mentioned coming back next session. There's even been a little chatter of another special session. We'll see if that plays out. But a number of conversations going on about tackling insurance in particular. And again, that's not a one silver bullet recipe to address that. I think a number of things have to be done. I know the legislature has looked at roads. They have looked at possible tort reform. They've looked at a number of different things that factor into high insurance costs to try to get more underwriters here into our state and ultimately make our roads safer, make our drivers better.
Thank you, Aaron. The rain, what's left, will clear soon, then highs today of 71, 78 tomorrow, 50% chance for showers on Thanksgiving, highs in the mid-70s. And I don't know if they're quite sure about the timing of the front yet, when the temperature begins to drop, but highs Friday only of 60, same for Saturday and Sunday. Then Monday, even cooler, highs then of only 54 and into the lower 60s only until next Wednesday. So you'll be able to get those sweaters out, again, if you remember where you put them. Becky Mowbray joins us right now, President and CEO of BGR, and Susie Dudas, Senior Research Analyst for BGR. Good morning, ladies. How are y'all?
Good morning. Doing fine. Thank you
for having us on.
You bet. Everybody ready for Thanksgiving?
Absolutely.
I guess so.
Today is National Cake Day, and on a lighter note, before we get to serious business, Becky, you got a favorite cake?
Ooh, chocolate auberge. I mean, you can't beat that.
And what about you, Susie?
Coconut cream.
I don't know if you heard my idea with it. One yellow layer, one white layer. Anyway, we'll talk more about that later. Let's talk about if you've been driving around Jefferson Parish schools, you've seen the sign "Support Jefferson Parish Public Schools." And you may have wondered what that's about, and I don't know who wants to start here. You ladies can decide. But what's on a ballot on December 7th, and what do Jefferson voters have to decide?
Sure, I'll take that, Tommy. On December 7th, Jefferson Parish voters will be asked to consider whether to approve a new tax to fund raises in the Jefferson Parish school system. Jefferson Parish has been finding that it's having a hard time hanging on to teachers. It's been losing more than 500 a year each year since the pandemic, which makes it really hard for the school system to achieve its learning objectives and achieve the student outcomes that it wants to if you've got this constant churn in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So the school system is talking about it would like to put in a pay raise funded by a tax that would cover not only teachers, but us other school employees as well, other school system employees as well. And it's on the December 7th ballot. Early voting is open now. And BGR took a close look at the proposal, and we came out in favor of it. We felt like the school system had done appropriate planning. They had tried to do everything they could with using money they had saved from schools that they had closed to fund raises, but it's just not enough to get there and accomplish what they want to accomplish. BGR found that it would be a good move that would help stabilize classrooms and ultimately lead to more effective outcomes with students in the parish.
For people in Jefferson Parish that vote for this, what is it going to, is there an average of what it's going to cost them per year with the millage?
So the millage levied, the maximum rate is 10.89 mils. So for every $100,000 of home value over the homestead exemption that you have, that's going to be $108.90 that you would have there. And so we looked at, and our report has it, the average home price recently in Jefferson Parish was $320,000. With the homestead exemption, that total, if you had a house of that value, that would run you about $266.
Do you know, have they done any polling on this? Do you know if people seem to be in favor of this or not? And I'm just wondering about, I don't know how many people in Jefferson Parish use the public school system, how many use private schools, how many realize the importance of public education, whether they use it or not. Thoughts from either one of you?
We don't look at things like polling. I mean, our role at BGR is to analyze the actual proposal itself and whether the organization has been a good financial steward of resources in the past, whether there's a good plan, and most importantly, whether it's likely to lead to effective outcomes for the public. In this case, we found that it would, and while the 10.89 mil tax is a significant request of voters at a time when many people are feeling squeezed, it is one that would support a core building block for the future success of the parish's family's economy and quality of life. Schools are, everyone has an interest in a well-functioning school system, regardless of whether you have kids in the system, because it's so central to the future of a parish and its economy.
Totally agree. When we come back, we'll talk about outcomes and where this would put the salaries of Jefferson Parish teachers, where they are now as it relates to other parishes and where this would put them. And I presume this millage is in perpetuity, or does it sunset at some point?
So, like all of the school systems, go ahead, Becky, or do you want me to?
No, Susie. No, Susie. Go.
Like all of the school systems' millages, I believe right now, it would be for 10 years and then would come up for renewal after 10 years.
Got you.
Voters get a chance to see how it works and then weigh in again in 10 years.
All right, we'll take a break, pick it up. We come back 7:20 now. Traffic, WWL. 724 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Becky Mowbray, President and CEO of BGR, Susie Dudas. Susie, I'm saying that right, huh?
Yes, okay. You are correct.
Senior research analyst for BGR about the ballot proposal for a new millage that would fund teacher pay raises. If I'm saying anything wrong, I'm trying to encapsulate this. Y'all please jump in and let me know. And it would cost about, give me that number again, the average tax, the average homeowner, about $108, is that what you said?
So $108.90 for every $100,000 of your home value over that $75,000 homestead exemption.
Gotcha. So it would raise, tell me about the where teacher salaries are in Jefferson Parish right now, what it would raise them to, and how that relates to other parishes in the state, please. Somebody.
Sure. So Jefferson Parish right now, the starting salary for a certified teacher is $51,800, which is kind of in, it's a little higher than some, but there's kind of this pack, which is all together of a lot of local school systems in the $50,000 range. This would put them up, it's an $8,300 raise. This would put them up to just over the current highest in the Southeast Louisiana area, would put them up to $60,100, which is just above Plaquemines and St. Charles parishes, where right now they're at $60,000.
So one question I have is, does this look, competition's a good thing. I'm not against competition, but I just wondered, does this draw teachers away from Plaquemines or away from Orleans Parish, or does it invite more people?
One of the big things in talking with the school system that they, you know, they say that in looking at exit interviews, that they lose teachers to some of the higher paying parishes. St. Charles in particular is one that they've mentioned. So part of this is to stem, you know, they see it stemming their losses to parishes, that people may come over to Jefferson, be there for a year, get a little bit of experience, mm-hmm. and can find another opportunity, a better paying opportunity, that they will take that. So part of this measure with, obviously, yeah, there is competition, is to try to stop getting new teachers and then losing them if other school systems or even other sectors in the private sector are paying better.
And I guess at some point, somebody ran the numbers with Jefferson Parish school system and figured that, I guess you got to balance a lot of different things, what the voters are likely to approve and how much you can pay teachers, but that raising the Jefferson teacher to like $60,000 would be the sweet spot?
Based on, again, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, how much when they're figuring this, they feel like, you know, overall they can have for a millage rate that voters would accept, what is that going to generate, and then translating that to how large a raise. And certainly, you know, their goal of being very competitive with the school systems that are currently the highest.
And to be clear, BGR, what you do is you look at the way this has been vetted, what they're asking for, what they've done in the past, how they propose to spend the money, and what kind of outcomes they're going to achieve. That's what you're looking at, accurate?
Yes. Yeah. We look at the strength of the proposal itself and whether it is, you know, worthy for voters to consider. When voters go to the ballot box on election day, they decide, you know, is this something I want to pay for? But we do the analysis of the proposal because it would be really hard for citizens on their own to, you know, come up with the type of information that we were able to assess whether, you know, whether it's likely to lead to effective outcomes. And I should say, we have put in this report that should the school system find that it doesn't need the full amount of the millage that they're asking for, you know, we recommend that they like not avail themselves of the full amount if they find that they come to a point that they've got the money they need and, you know, spare taxpayers if they can possibly do so.
I got it.
But part of the...
Go ahead, finish, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, part of the issue is that teacher salaries can be so low in Louisiana. There are also teachers that are leaving for other states as well. And, you know, the in general, you need to try to induce more people to go into the profession of teaching or to stay in it rather than switching to a different career.
And a text comes in here. I just would pose the question. I don't know if you know the answer or not, but why was this not on the November 5th ballot?
We do not know the answer to that.
You think there'd been a bigger turnout. Thank you, ladies. I appreciate your time. Have a nice Thanksgiving. Becky Mowbray, Susie Dudas, President and CEO of BGR, and Senior Research Analyst for BGR, respectively. They say the BGR is in favor of that school tax proposition. It's going to be on the ballot on December 7th. We'll talk to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, when we come back. Get the latest on the Wisner Trust saga and Tulane and all that stuff right now. Time for WWL First News. All righty, here we go, 7:44, 16 till 8. Today is National Cake Day. I'm Tommy Target, this is WWL, by the way, and I'm asking you to text in what's your favorite cake. Just a little lighter subject, but when it comes to what we're about to talk about, it would seem as though Tulane wants to have its cake and eat it, too. Joe Geruso joins us now, New Orleans City Council member. How you doing, Joe?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Let's talk about this Wisner Trust for people and what's going on with Tulane and the council for people that don't know. I guess we need to give a little bit of background on the legal history of this Wisner Trust and how it got to this point.
Sure. So the Wisner Trust was a trust created by Edward Wisner in 1914 for the benefit of the city of New Orleans, include lands in the greater New Orleans metropolitan area. And the sort of the crown jewel now is Port Fouchon, which obviously works on oil and gas and helps produce that here in the nation, not just for Louisiana. And the trust had these income beneficiaries, people who were supposed to get certain amounts of money from the revenue that was generated each year, including LSU, Tulane, Salvation Army, the city, and then later the Wisner heirs. But at all times, the trust was set to expire 100 years from the time it was created in 2014. About a few years after 2014, I can't remember if it was 15 or 16, then Mayor Landrieu filed a suit to say that the trust had expired and to make sure that those trust assets would remain with the city. The courts have ruled that the trust is over with. But it sounds like the trust continued for a couple of years after that operating, even though it shouldn't have been. And then in 2020, Mayor Cantrell signed a ratification agreement extending the trust. And our view has always been that that trust ratification was an absolute nullity, which means it just has no force of law. And the simplest way I can explain it is when a trust is dead, it is like a person. It is dead. It cannot be revived. It cannot be resuscitated. Nothing can be done to bring it back. And the mayor, in signing that, also violated the law by not including the council who's responsible for disposing of a movable property like is the trust assets here. So the council had to wound up suing the trust, the heirs, Tulane, LSU, et cetera. And we've had a series of legal fights over the last couple of years on the margins, including whether or not the council was a legal entity and our ability to stop the sort of the revenues from being distributed because we thought the trust has expired. So we now have a court date in September 2025 for finally having a hearing or trial on this matter. The parties are going to hash all this out in motion practice over the next couple of months. The city still has not really said what its position is relative to everything overall, but the council has filed one motion that says the 2020 agreement is null and void, and the trust can't be relied on, and all the parties are going to fight about who actually owns this property. The heirs claim that they have an ownership interest now. The council says absolutely not. That's not the case at all. And with regards to Tulane and LSU, I think the council's view has always been, we understand that we're going to continue to do business together. We want to do business together. There's this big charity project that's in the city. we want to support the charity project. We understand its importance. In fact, the council allocated $10 million in this last budget cycle in order to help with the housing side of this. But at the same time, the council has now passed an ordinance saying we're not going to give economic development money to anybody who's adverse to us in the Wisner litigation, because our feeling is the trust is over, it's expired, it's over with, and yet the people who are the defendants, including Tulane and LSU, keep on fighting us on every step of the way. And our view is we need to have the Wisner litigation resolved with those parties before we can talk about giving them more money. And just very simply, this is the way I feel about it. I've learned in government when people say they want to be your partner, that frequently means do what we want and stop telling me what to do. And that's not the way I view a partnership. The way I view a partnership is you're trying to do business together and making sure you're as equal as humanly possible. And so in this instance, we feel like if you want to pursue the lawsuit, you can go ahead and keep on doing that. But it's really hard for us to say at the other end, we're going to give you money for this economic development project, while at the same time, we're embroiled in this litigation that frankly should not have stretched out this long, should not have taken so much time, money, effort, and that we really ought to be focused on the bigger prize, which is charity. And so our hope is you hear us loud and clear and you're ready to negotiate in good faith, which has not happened as much as we would like to have seen over the last couple of years.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back. One of my favorite movies is Dr. Strangelove, and Slim Pickens has a line now, and he says, it's been to one World's Fair, a picnic, and a rodeo, and that's the stupidest thing he's ever heard. And this seems to me a similar situation. It should have been taken care of back in 2014, I think it was, right, when the trust expired. It was 2016. Then you had Mayor Landrieu passively letting it continue. Then you got Mayor Cantrell actively making a whatever it seems like a backroom deal. Has she ever spoken out about why she did this?
No.
And as a result, God knows how much money is involved here with the litigation, not to mention somebody wants to know how much money is involved with this trust. We'll talk about that when we come back with Joe Geruso, also about the charity project. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. Joe, you're looking forward to Thanksgiving weekend? Just maybe take 4 days and unplug?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, love spending time with the family and eating.
Thank God almighty. Somebody texted and said, how much money is involved with this trust, Joe?
Yeah, it's between $110 and $175 million. So it is real money.
This is cumulative or per year?
That is the total amount that the trust is worth. I think they've dispersed in the revenue per year between $7 and $13 million, just depending on what the price of oil has been.
And so with that money that the city should have gotten for all of those years, that's a considerable amount of money. You'd think there'd be some interest on that as well?
Well, yeah, there would be interest on that, and we have dispersed these funds to Tulane, LSU, the heirs. And remember last time I was on the air with you, we talked about how this is mailbox money. People want to know that it's coming regularly. And look, one of the things we've done is amended our lawsuit to say if we are the owners, which we truly believe that we are, and we think the law supports our position, then we're going to seek to get back, to be reimbursed, disgorge all of those funds that have been paid for as long as we possibly can. And to your point, I don't understand, as we look at this charity project, why the bigger actors in this, in our view, are being penny-wise and pound foolish.
That's what it seems like.
Because the money that they get, their percentages are very low in all of this. The money that they get each year is really not that much, but the money that they need for charity is a big deal. And they need money both from the city and the state to make the deal work. The state is not going to give them money if the city doesn't give them money. And we have repeatedly said to them, we want to negotiate. We want to be work with you in good faith to try and get all of this ironed out. But if you want 120 cents on the dollar, it's going to be hard for us to do a deal.
Yeah, let me get to this real quick. And, Joe, we only have 60 seconds, but somebody wants to know that the city believes out of – why does the city believe that out of all of the beneficiaries of the former trust, they're the ones that's entitled to the property now that the trust is over? But that's the way the trust was set up, correct?
That's 100% how the trust was set up way back in 1914, and everybody has acted like that until the trust was expiring.
And LaToya Cantrell decided to go into an agreement to extend it.
Correct. And for in perpetuity, which does not exist.
That's crazy. Thank you, Joe. Have a nice Thanksgiving, all right?
Same to you, Tommy.
Unplug,
take care.
Unplug, get away from all that stuff. We come back, we're going to talk to Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney, about the French Quarter shooting. Who was out of jail? Who was on an ankle monitor? Is it the judge? Is it Rafael Goyeneche, Metropolitan Crime Commission, saying that the deal should never have been struck in the first place? So we'll address all of that with Jason Williams, DA, when we come back on WWL. 8:14, 8:15 now on this Tuesday morning before Thanksgiving. District Attorney Jason Williams joins us now. Hey, Jason, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thank you for taking the time with us. Let's get right to business. Talk about this French Quarter shooting and ankle monitors and so forth. Give me, as they say, the facts of the case, if you will, please.
So you've got three perpetrators that we know of at this point. They've been identified by the NOPD, do some very diligent work in the use of some force multipliers in the sense of Project NOLA, Brian Lagarde, the network of crime cameras, was able to quickly identify people and cars that were involved in this thing. One has been detained. Two are at large. They should be considered armed and dangerous. We are using every open source piece of intelligence that we can find to identify anyone who assists these two men in any way, a ride, a car, a piece of bread. So we're looking at social media, we're looking at cameras, we're looking at license plate readers. So I just want to warn any family and friends who think they're just helping someone out of a tough situation and they're committing a crime that they assist these two in any way.
And to be clear, we're talking about Daniel Miorana and Daryl Adams, right?
That's correct. His brother Nicholas Miorana is in custody now.
And you said considered armed and dangerous. You know, I saw you say, Jason, when this all happened, you don't want thoughts and prayers. You want tips and leads, right? How has that been working out?
Well, it's working out really well. You know, New Orleans is a very small place. Everyone knows everyone. People know the flavor snowball you had in the middle of the day by the evening, by the time you get home. The information is going to come in. It's going to be found out. I just would hate for someone who is ignorant of the law to ruin their life because these three men have ruined theirs. And that's exactly what's going to happen. We've identified some creative charging structures. We're looking at a terrorism statute for anybody that engages in a mass shooting, because I believe that is, in fact, terrorism, which bumps up the accessory after the fact, aiding and abetting, but bumps up the time they would serve significantly from 5 years to double-digit years if anyone assists these two in any way.
Is the U.S. Marshal's office operating on this or not, Jason, or do you want to say?
This is an all-hands-on-deck piece. Big thanks goes out to the FBI, the U.S. Marshal Services, and Louisiana State Police. Everyone has been helping out Chief Ann on this. Lieutenant Andrew Waldron is one of the best police officers on the NOPD, son of veteran retired Judge Dennis Waldron. He knows his way around the law. He knows how to do it fair. He knows how to do it right. And we're going to find these men.
Let's talk about the ankle monitoring piece of this, if you will, please, and what happened.
Sure. So we, using the evidence that we had available, prosecuted Nicholas Miorana earlier this year. We were only able to get a conviction that led to probation. To my dismay, I wanted him to be in custody. That wasn't available. I know that some critics have said, well, why would he get probation for felon with a firearm? Well, the answer to that, Tommy, is you got constructive possession and you got actual possession. The officers who investigated that case, the charge was that he illegally discharged a firearm and he was a felon, so he was also charged with felon possession of a firearm. The issue is the officer investigating that case did not pick up the casings or secure the video footage of the shooting.
Wait, Jason,
and there was no gun.
Slow down a little bit, because I want you to explain that again, because I know you've taken some heat. And I'll say Rafael Goyeneche was saying the case shouldn't have been pled down, and I don't want to, you know, pit one against the other, but I just want the facts to get out there. And look, let me just get on my soapbox for a minute here. You can go back all the way in terms of this French Quarter shooting and say, well, you can go back to the way that these people were raised and where did they break bag and decided, right, that led to this eventually. Or you can say, and we'll get to that after the break, about the ankle monitor and the judge should have put out the order to have them picked up. But I think it might be a little bit disingenuous, with all due respect, to go back and say, well, the case shouldn't have been pled down, when the facts of the case are, and go ahead and repeat that part about the investigation and the casings, because I think that's a very important part of this.
So the person was charged with illegal discharge of a weapon, and then when they found out that he was a felon, he was later charged with felon possession of a firearm. However, no firearm was ever seized from this individual. The casings could not be matched to any weapon and were not properly stored. And the video footage, which we would have absolutely used to get the mandatory minimum sentence on felon with a firearm, just wasn't seized from the hotel to show that that was him in that parking lot. And that's not a case we can prove in court. You know, and so we were left with the evidence that we had, and we got the most serious convictions we could get. You know, I understand, you know, people look at it on paper and you think, oh, well, there's a mandatory minimum there. But we have to have the evidence to present to a jury in order to achieve that goal. And we did. Now, he violated the probation that the judge put him on in very short order after getting it. And there was a revocation here. And over my objection, the judge decided to release him back into the community after we had gotten him back in custody for the violation of the probation, and he was released on an ankle monitor.
So the probation really, I hate to say red herring, but it all goes back, again, to the judge, Jason, as I understand this, because he violated probation even before this ankle monitoring thing, and the judge released him again. Accurate?
That's it. Those are the facts of this particular case.
All right, let me take a break. I want to pick it up on ankle monitoring when we come back, all right?
Sure.
Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney, 821. Quick look at traffic now, WWL. 825, quickly back to Jason Williams, New Orleans District Attorney. So Nicholas Marana, 28, he's in jail. One count of second-degree murder, three counts of attempted murder for the spray of bullets in the French Quarter on Thursday afternoon. And he was out after a plea bargain was made for a felon in conviction of in possession of a firearm. I'm trying to race through this, Jason. Correct me if I'm saying anything wrong. The case was less than strong, so you got what you could. But even with that, he violated parole after the plea bargain, and the judge, Leon Roche, let him out again, correct? And put him on an ankle monitor?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, after that violation, he was put back in custody where he stayed for several months of this year. And then over our objection, the judge denied the revocation and then put him on the ankle monitor 24 hours house arrest, where he continued to violate the terms of the conditions of that release. And he was violating the terms and conditions of that release when he drove that car into the French Quarter with those other two men in it.
So was this a Matt Dennis ankle monitor, or was the judge made aware, do you know, Jason, of the fact that this Marana was violating? Go ahead.
This was an ASAP ankle bracelet that Matt Dennis's company owns.
So I know the judge and knew it, right?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Dennis has said that over 40 different violations were reported to the court. And I believe that when there's a single violation reported to the court, when the court gets that, they're basically being told this person is not doing or living up to the things that you have required. And I believe that should be an immediate revocation, regardless of the charge, regardless of the violation, because this is a second chance. This person was already on probation. The case was less than perfect, and that's fine. Every case isn't perfect. We have to deal with what we have to. But when a person gets on probation, that's a different status.
And if they don't do anything right and we get him back in custody, they should remain in custody under violation of that.
So he was released over your objection. Then after that, if we're looking for where the system failed, Matt Dennis's ankle monitor worked. How many violations did you say?
At least 40. Mr. Dennis, I think, has indicated there were more days of violations than there were actual compliance days.
And I know Matt Dennis, and I know damn well that he notified the judge. I'd be willing to bet my house on it. I don't have any evidence in front of me, but knowing the reputation of ASAP that and the way Matt Dennis does his business, that the judge was made aware of this 40 times before the French Quarter shooting. That's what we're saying, right?
I've seen the documentation. Matt Dennis did everything that was required of him and actually went above and beyond what the law actually requires to make notification to the court.
So it would be hard, Jason, for me to look at anybody in this chain of events to point the finger at other than the judge. Am I wrong in presuming that?
You know, obviously the men who made the choice to fire weapons are the ones at fault. But we have to, when we have an opportunity, if someone has proven that they're not deserving of a second chance or probation, it's time to lock them up. That's not harsh. That's not mean. That's not cruel. That's just the law. And I think it's fairly simple. It's just accountability.
So I want to be clear. To be clear, the guy, after you plea bargained the case, he violated his probation. He was back in custody. You wanted him to stay there. Judge Leon Roche, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, let him out. After he let him out on an ankle monitor, he violated the ankle monitor 40 times. Matt Dennis notified Judge Roche of this, but yet he was still out on the street and committed allegedly this French Quarter shooting. And I say allegedly because he hasn't been convicted yet. And you've seen
correct.
The documentation that Judge Roche was notified, and it was up to Judge Roche, correct me if I'm wrong, at any point during these 40 violations or notifications to say, that's it, go pick him up.
That's exactly what the court record says.
Okay. So what happens from here?
You know, and he was wearing the ankle monitor when he committed this crime, which tells you what he thought of the ankle monitor. You know, I mean, let's just factor out what we're doing to the culture here. If someone is going to commit a crime and they're going to wear the ankle monitor, they are certain that there's not a ramification of where they go in terms of violating the geographical boundaries.
So you have evidence, I would think, from Matt Dennis putting him at the crime scene.
That was part of the technological force multiplier that was able to identify this suspect.
All right, real quick before we let you go, Jason, I'm glad you cleared all this up. If somebody does have any information about any of these people, what do they do?
They call Crime Stoppers, they call the NOPD, and if they do anything to assist, aid, or abet, they will be prosecuted as well, and that they will be tied to the terrorism statute as well.
And to be clear, you're saying armed and dangerous, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate your time. Hoping your mom and everybody, the whole family, have a nice Thanksgiving, all right?
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Tom, and the whole WWL family.
Thank you, sir. Jason Williams, DA. We'll talk with a medical director and owner of Kronos Wellness, Dr. Mae Scott, about the Biden administration and weight loss drugs and more when we come back. 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by Dr. Scott, Mae Scott, beg your pardon. I got it backward there, but that's easy to do, isn't it, Doc?
Yes, it is. Good morning, Tommy. How are you doing
today?
I'm
well, sir. Dr. Mae Scott, medical director and owner of Kronos Body Health and Wellness. Talk about these weight loss drugs, and I'd like to keep, you know, I'd hate to even use the word Biden here because everything gets so politically, you know what I'm saying? You get on one side of the spectrum or the other, but the Biden administration proposed requiring Medicare and Medicaid to cover anti-obesity drugs like the semaglutide or whatever the different names of them are. And I just want to set the table for you, Doc. I lost, for people that don't know, about 100 pounds, kept it off for about 2 years now by using, what is it, Zeripatide, I think is the name of it. Which one is that?
Trizepatide.
And I'm a big proponent of these things, but that's just from my own anecdotal experience because I know in terms of diabetes and everything else, not that I had diabetes, but I was certainly pre-diabetic being that overweight, what a difference it's made in my life in terms of being able to exercise and everything else. And I'll get off my soapbox in a second. It would seem like this would be the most cost-effective thing that we could do when it comes to healthcare. With that, I'll step off and leave the stage to you, Doc.
Well, Tommy, you're right. These are just, they're amazing drugs. We have seen people losing 60, 80, 100 pounds fairly easily on this medication over a period of time. You know, I have to tell you, though, one thing I was on your show several months ago, and I said something that was not correct. I wanted to clear up. Now, you were asking me about how these medications seem to work on the brain and how you felt so much better, and not just physically, but mentally. And my initial reaction back then was, oh, it's just because of what you're eating. But, you know, they have found these medicines cross the blood-brain barrier. They react directly to your brain, and they're sent, these receptors are all over your body. And they're finding they're doing amazing things, Tommy, that they're neuroprotective. They found they can slow down the process of dementia. They're cardioprotective. They increase contractility of the heart and improve your cardiac function. They can help people who have renal insufficiency. They decrease inflammation. So this is just a revolutionary drug that they have right now, and they need to find a way to get it to people and you know, get it to the masses, because it seems to be so safe. There's so few contraindications. And yes, sir, you are right. It does help people with diabetes, of course, and with obesity, and it just helps to decrease potential chronic illnesses. There are just so many amazing things that we're seeing with this medicine.
My age is a closely kept secret, doctor, but I'm somewhere between, let's just say, middle-aged and a codger, okay? Somewhere in between there. But I do like the mental acuity that it gives me, and I don't think I have dementia or anything like that, but it does help with a little memory issue that I might have here or there, some of that due to some headache medicine that I take. In terms of cost effectiveness to the healthcare system in the nation, man, it just seems like this is a no-brainer. What am I missing?
Well, I think part of what you're missing is that the majority of patients are on a form of insurance. Insurance does not want to pay for it because they think about the bottom line this year. You know, if they said, okay, we're going to approve this drug for everyone, they'll be bankrupt in no time. So, of course, it would benefit everyone in the future, decreasing chronic illnesses, decreasing obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes. But that's a long-term goal, and that's long-term projection. That's not going to help the bottom line this year. So you're seeing insurance companies pushing back on paying. Some of them have. There were some insurance companies that we found that were starting out paying for these medications, but after they realized the expense, they pulled back on it and stopped. So it's all about making money.
Well, I'm going to say this. I'm going to leave you out of it because we'll go to a break, and then we'll pick it up when we come back. But if you look at the actuarial tables, Tim, you can bring the doctor down because I don't want to get him involved in my mess here. But if you look at the actuarial tables, the insurance companies, and they're in money to make business, rather than pay for these drugs to keep you healthy and in the long term have to pay less on the other side of it in terms of health care, the middle portion of that is people die and they don't have to pay anything, and that's what they're opting for. It's ugly, but it's the truth. If you have any questions or comments about weight loss drugs, 504-260-1870. I work out a lot as well, but I don't think I'd be working out if it weren't for losing weight in the first place. 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 856, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to our friend, Dr. Mace Scott, medical director, owner of Kronos Body Health and Wellness Services, and you can find out more if you go to kronosbhw.com. And, doctor, one thing I wanted to say, and, you know, I mentioned that I work out a lot, and I don't think that I would be doing it had I not lost the weight, but one of the things that you guys do is that you don't just look at it from, you know, here, take your injection and that's it. It is a whole wellness, I guess, discipline, right?
Approach, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we try to do. We do offer a free nutritionist consultation with every weight loss patient, those that will take it. Unfortunately, most do not accept it. But we also have a fitness center and trainers, and we like to try and use all of these together to help the person get better, improve their weight, and change habits, and that's really important. But I have seen exactly what you're saying, that when people do lose weight and they get back in shape, they find that motivation again that they lost. It's so hard to get over that hump, you know, to get back started again with healthy eating and healthy habits.
It has changed completely the way I eat. I was at the store yesterday, true story, And a guy came up to me and said, "You're pretty ripped for an old dude." And I didn't know if that was a nice thing or not. I didn't know how to react. I don't know what you say to that exactly. Let's talk about somebody texted in. I think it's a fair question about long-term what's the word I'm thinking of? Negative effects of these
potential side effects.
Yeah, side effects and all that stuff. Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a handful of people that don't do well on this medicine. Very, very few, but some people do have issues with nausea and vomiting, cramping, things like that. You can get pancreatitis because this medicine does react with the pancreas, and it can cause inflammation of your pancreas. That is not the same thing as pancreatic cancer. It's just inflammation of the pancreas that will generally resolve. It just means you cannot take the medicine ever again. But for as far as long-term, there are no significant long-term problems other than that. Well, there is a case or two of what's called gastroparesis, where the stomach slows down and stops moving. But, Tommy, actually, these medicines, they bind to the GLP-1 receptor. There have been similar medicines out for decades, Trulicity, liraglutide. So when semaglutide came along under the name Ozempic, it was approved by the FDA for type 2 diabetes in 2017. It has been used continuously in people since then. And, of course, its predecessors have been used for years, decades, and has been shown to be safe. So I don't really think we're going to come across some long-term issue over the next couple of decades. I think we've already seen the problems.
Doctor, if you can, in the minute that's left, tell me how it, for people that don't understand these drugs, and we've talked about it a lot, but what it does in your brain so that it does change the way you're wired when it comes to controlling how you eat and what you eat?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, it binds to receptors all over the body. It's primarily going to affect your brain, your pancreas, and your gut. And in your brain, it kind of slows down the cravings and the food noise that you get. You know, that craving for the snack, whatever your favorite snack is, Coca-Cola, whatever. It seems to calm that down so people don't think about it. You don't really think about food like you did before. In your pancreas, go ahead.
I just say we're out of time, but I heard the phrase, somebody used it, Lucy Bustamante, as a matter of fact, a long time ago, used the phrase grazing when we were talking about this. And that's what you do. You get up and you go graze in the kitchen, even though you're not hungry, and I don't find the need to graze anymore. Doctor, thank you. I appreciate your time. Hope y'all have a great Thanksgiving. Y'all, you can go to Chronos, ChronosBHW.com, and find out a lot more about all of this and the holistic approach that they take over there. And I'm just, you know, the medicine's not magic, but it is a big help and a big step toward getting yourself healthy. We'll take a break, come back, talk about the Turkey Day race and more. All right, 9:09 as we make our way through Tuesday morning, heading toward Thanksgiving Eve. And we thought we'd talk about the Turkey Day race. I used to run this thing every year, and then the knees went out, and I got replacement knees. They say you're not supposed to run, but you can still walk. And this is something that goes on and has been going on for quite some time in City Park every Thanksgiving, and it's amazing how big it is. Benjamin Burke joins us now, Executive Race Director, New Orleans Track Club. How you doing, Ben?
Good, sir. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about this year's Turkey Day race.
Yes, sir. So, yeah, we have a great race lined up this year. One of the things I did do differently with the event is that I partnered up with Hubick's Pies because since 2011, when their unfortunate fire happened, you know, this is the first year since then that they've had the ability to have their beloved favorite, the sweet potato flavor pie. So I ended up partnering up with them. So everybody who participates in the event will finish and get a sweet potato pie.
That's awesome. Tell me about the route.
The route, yeah. So the route will start on Roosevelt Mall right outside of Tag Gormley. It'll head down to Stadium Drive, and then it'll loop around to Dreyfus, head up Lee Long by Noma, hit the traffic circle, head up Henry Thomas, and then go up to Zachary Taylor, then U-turn at the Harrison Traffic Circle, and then go back and finish inside on the 50-yard line on the track in Tag Gormley.
Now, one thing I know, Ben, from running this thing years and years ago for about 10 years is that you can run. It's not meters. It's 5 miles. It can take an hour to do this, but when you enter Tag Gormley Stadium, you feel like you're finishing the marathon in the Olympics. Am I right?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. We've dressed it up really nice over the past couple of years with all kind of signage and fencing. And, you know, one thing that's really, really cool about this event is that it's super family-oriented. You know, we see so many families, so many walkers out there. One thing I did do this year is that this route, the route has changed over the years, obviously, but for this five-mile route, I got it USA Track and Field certified. So it is a certified course. So that just adds a little onto the top of this great event already.
What motivated me to do it back in the day was to, when I had my original knees, was, you know, you go out there, you get up early, you go out, man, you get some exercise, you feel great, then you get ready to eat a big old Thanksgiving dinner, right?
Yeah. You burn the calories, burn some off before you eat them all day, take them in all day. So no, that's what it's all about, and especially our beneficiary, Spina Bifida, who's been amazing over these past years. So I just want to give them a shout out as well.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. You're reading ahead. That's where I was going next, Ben. Tell me about who it benefits and what they do.
Yeah, Spina Bifida of Louisiana, you know, is a volunteer organization group. You know, they support services, equipment, counseling, tutoring. It's a very most common of newborns, and it happens in their, you know, multiple sclerosis and stuff. So yeah, we partnered with them and 1977. So, you know, I could go into the history too of the event.
Yeah, I'm going back to maybe, I guess the 80s when I did it for the first time, I would think.
Yeah. So it's something that a lot of people here in the city and around the country don't realize, that this race is the fifth oldest race in America. Only behind, it's right behind the Yonkers Half Marathon in New York. It's 117 years old this year. It was started by Francis Thomas Gormley, Tad Gormley, mm-hmm. which it also finishes inside a stadium. And then in the same year, Tad Gormley also started the third oldest race in the country that's here as well, the Jackson Day Race. It's in the Battle of New Orleans in Chalmette in January. So, you know, those are some cool things that, you know, you can check off your bucket list. Hey, you know, I did the fifth oldest race in the country. So, it's really special. I'm blessed to have this opportunity to be the race director for this event. And, you know, we're expecting somewhere between 3,400 and 3,500 on Thanksgiving morning.
Tell me about that, if you will, Benjamin. The numbers, like, from years to years, where running was really the thing to do, and I don't know if people have gotten away from it or not. How has participation in the race changed from way back in the day to now?
Yeah, so I think COVID definitely hurt. It did. The industry as a whole. But before that, I think, yes, people were more adamant about getting out and running. But I tell you what, Tommy, I think it is definitely coming back. I mean, we've seen big spikes around the entire industry and you know, with people coming out, getting, you know, COVID's way behind us now. So, this could be, you know, one of our largest years ever in recent. Yes, sir. Yep.
I'm sorry. And you don't have to run. You can walk, is what I wanted to say. The whole family can go out there and walk if you want and support Spina Bifida.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Walk. And then not only that, you get we have, you know, some post-race refreshments. Everybody gets a free bag of Kachava protein or a promo code for it. So we have some cool other things too. But yes, walk, run, skip, jog, come out.
Tell me about the T-shirt.
So the T-shirt, the T-shirt, we had it this year. It was based off the past Olympics that happened. So it's a T-shirt that shows running through Paris, because we have, you know, an affiliation, you know, with the French heritage here. So that's kind of the route we took this year. We've seen great feedback. It's a purple shirt. So, make sure you sign up ASAP, because, you know, if we sign up on race day, you know, you're not guaranteed a shirt. So try to get that in as early as possible.
How do you do that? How do you sign up?
So you can sign up. You can head over to turkeydayrace.com. You'll find all the information there. We actually have a packet pickup starting at 12 noon today, the last day for packet pickup. It's from 12 to 6 at New Orleans Athletic Club, who owns the event. Their address is 222 North Rampart.
Or you can pick it up the day of the event if you pre-register.
You could, but it's strongly encouraged to pick it up today, because you'd also be able to lock in that shirt, lock in those free stuff that we have, those giveaway items. So it's just encouraged.
Can you?
And
can you register today and pick it up today?
Correct.
Okay.
You can register on site today. We close registration an hour before race start. So we give a lot of leeway and a lot of options for people to, make that last minute decision.
I appreciate your time. I really do, Benjamin. It's a great cause, a great race. What's the record, do you know, for fastest time ever?
I'm not sure. I wish I did. I know. Maybe next year I'll have that for you.
I would guess 22 minutes. Maybe?
Probably. So, yeah, probably.
Four plus?
You know, 5 minutes. Yeah, four, five, something like that. So, I'll make sure I get that.
25 minutes, something like that. And then for people that are walking, I'm getting some texts here, people that are walking, at what point do you shut it down?
We usually get 20 minutes a mile. So you got plenty of time. We've never had that issue. So,
all right, my friend, I might see you out there. It sounded like something to get the
8:30 start.
You got it. Thank you, Benjamin Burke, Executive Director, Race Director, New Orleans Track Club, the 117th, I think you said, annual Turkey Day race. And I did it a couple of years. I'm going to do it this year. I'm going to go walk 5 miles and get my Thanksgiving Day started. 9:18, we'll come back. We'll talk about holidays and mental health here on WWL. It is currently 9:24, and we spoke yesterday about the etiquette of the holidays and manners and how you react with other people. And today we thought we'd look at it from a mental health standpoint, because sometimes people can suffer with mental health issues. We're concerned about that here, as we always are. We're concerned with that, and also about something that maybe we all can do to affect other people's mental health, whether we mean to do it or not. And for that, we're joined by our good friend, Dr. Judy Ho, a clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of The New Rules of Attachment, Stop Self-Sabotage, all of that. Those books are available either like an audiobook, right, Dr. Judy, or you can get them at Amazon and all that stuff?
Yeah, you can get them like any format. So we got audiobook, we got Kindle, we got hard copy, name it.
do you read the book or not? On the audiobook.
Do I read my own book?
No, on the audiobook.
Yes. I actually do read my own book on The New Rules of Attachment. I did not get to read my own book on Stop Self-Sabotage. But it's okay. I met the actor who did, and she was really nice.
Oh.
So I know.
Awesome.
They let me do it for my second book.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Let's talk about, first of all, how you been? How's Luca? How's everybody in the fam?
Luca's great. We just visited with some really, really close friends last night, actually. They were in town from Napa, and was actually my old roommate. This is a funny story, but, you know, this was back when we thought Craigslist was safe. That's how I met my roommate. I mean, turned out to be a real gem, but, you know, I don't think nowadays that's the best way to get a roommate. So, but we met very, very long ago, like 15 years ago.
Say that part again about the roommate.
Oh, I met my roommate, my old roommate, from Craigslist. It was 15 years ago, you know. We thought Craigslist was safe then.
Well, at least you're still alive. That's the main thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And in one piece.
Let's talk
about the holidays and why sometimes people suffer with the holidays, and then we'll move from there, Dr. Judy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the holidays, it just brings up a lot of different things for different people. It should be this time of family and togetherness and happiness, and I think that in part that's what makes it hard sometimes, because there's this expectation that is supposed to be this beautiful time of the year, right? And so then when you're not having such a beautiful time, you feel like something's wrong with you. I think that the expectations really do create this feeling that somehow it's not okay if you're suffering from sadness or if you're still fighting with your family, which of course it happens, because family friction occurs oftentimes around the holidays because there's more opportunities to get together. And even if you love your family, just some old habits die hard and some of the old issues, they can just come up whenever you get together with family. I have a lot of people tell me that when they're with their family, even as adults, you know, a lot of old patterns just come up, you know, any insecurities they had as children, feelings about how their parents treat them and their siblings differently, they all come back, even if it's been 20, 30 or 40 years. And then, you know, once you do have that argument, you feel terrible about it. You feel like you should be making up with them. You look at all these commercials and Hallmark movies, like everything's supposed to be great. And then those expectations come back to haunt you again. So I think that those are some of the reasons why the holidays can be really tough for people.
You know, you mentioned Hallmark movies and expectations. And boy, to me, it seems like sometimes people, you want this to be such a, you know, and because of the marketing involved and everything, and I'm a free market economist, and
sure.
I'm all for that. But because you're not just, you know, being urged to buy a sweater or this or that or the other thing, it seems like if you get this present for this person, then it's going to be this perfect holiday season. And nothing else in life is perfect. Nothing with your family is perfect. So why should it change during the holiday season? You got to manage those expectations, don't you?
Exactly. And I think that a lot of people have a hard time managing the expectations, because not only because of what happens on media, on social media, but also I think sometimes people are hoping for the best for themselves, which of course makes sense. It's like, well, maybe this year is going to be the year that's all different, you know, and that we're going to finally make up as a family, or, you know, maybe this is going to be the year that I conquer my depression. You know, those are the kinds of thoughts that go through people's heads. I think that holiday expectations are kind of similar to almost New Year expectations, right? You kind of, New Year rolls around, you think this is a great time for a fresh start and I'm going to make a resolution. It's kind of like that with the holidays too, though. You know, people are like, well, maybe this is going to be the holiday where everything's different. But like you said, it's just like any other time of year. So why do you put that pressure on yourself? I think that sometimes other people do it to you, and maybe they're even well-meaning, but you know, maybe you have that friend or family member who's like, oh, just let this go. It's the holidays. Why are you, you know, mad at that? It's like, well, you're allowed to have your feelings, but it doesn't help when your friends and your family say, hey, don't have them, or be nicer to them. It's the holidays. Think about that, right? That induces a lot of guilt and even shame. And shame is a really tough emotion to deal with.
Somebody texted in. I always like to bring the audience in, Dr. Judy. You know that. The Oconar Jeweler Talking text line, 504-260-1870. Yeah. Somebody said, do the holidays cause mental health issues, or do they just kind of like reveal them? That's a good question.
That's a good, really good question. I don't know. I mean, you know, at first I thought I had an answer, but I thought about it for a second and I thought, you know what? It's very possible that the holidays can trigger mental health concerns, because again, stress can trigger mental health concerns. The holidays are stressful, right? But also, I think the holidays can also reveal mental health concerns that you're having, or make them worse, because not only because of the expectations that we've been talking about, but, you know, there's actually also other environmental factors. For many people, the holidays are living in cold areas. And if you're living in cold areas, you don't get a lot of sun. Those are environmental factors that can also reveal mental health concerns. Some people have seasonal affective disorder or something similar to that, even if it's not the diagnosis. And then I think the other piece, too, is that holidays a lot of times actually bring around more downtime, right? That's kind of how our society is built. I mean, I started getting out-of-office notices yesterday from people. I was emailing them, right? It's like people are starting to take off a little bit more time, maybe a little early. And sometimes when you have too much downtime, you introspect a lot. That could be good to an extent. But then if you're already in a negative spiral, it leaves you a lot of time to be with your thoughts if they're not actually serving you.
You know, one thing I kind of learned about lately, and not intentionally, but, you know, the phrase triggers, and I never did really realize what that meant. But talk about that, if you will, Dr. Judy, about some triggers and how, and when you mentioned things like downward spirals, how you can notice yourself sometimes going down a road, it's like, well, wait, how the hell did I get here? It's like, kind of like when you're not paying attention when you're driving, and you all of a sudden you find yourself in a place where you don't want to be. Talk about that, if you will, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so sorry you're hearing Luca right now demanding early holiday.
We like Luca. That's fine.
Oh, you can you hear him now? Oh, thank you. Okay, let's go get your railroad. So basically, I think that people talk about trigger a lot. And triggers are something that's really personal to the individual. I think some people will say their triggers come from their childhood. And some people don't necessarily recognize that, but when they're in an interaction that reminds them of something that happened in their past, whether it's childhood or even in their adulthood, you know, they have a bigger emotional reaction than you might imagine, right? And that I think is the best way to know, to self-assess if something is a trigger or not, because when you know you had like a bigger than expected reaction to something, like, whoa, I really, that was kind of overblown. I think that's a way you would understand whether or not something had triggered you, because otherwise you would just have a reaction that I think is on the more normative range.
And there are things that bring back, like, a trigger. Is that something that brings back a memory of something else where it's like, well, wait a minute, because I'll find myself sometimes thinking, well, wait, how the hell did I get to thinking about this? But then, well, this reminded me of that, reminded me of that, reminded me of the other thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's kind of, as you just discussed, it's like that thought cascade, you know, just kind of keeps going and it doesn't stop. And then, like I said, when people just have time just to sit there and think about all of the things that have ever happened to them, you know, it isn't actually the healthiest, right? Because it's not actually productive. I think that sometimes people think erroneously that somehow worrying is productive. But most of the times after you worry about something, you don't actually have a game plan or nothing's really changed. And yet we keep doing it. It's kind of our mind's own way of tricking us into thinking we're doing something helpful when actually it's just making it worse. And so, you know, I think that when you do feel like you're triggered by something, that kind of thought loop can happen very, very quickly.
Somebody texted in and said they have a problem with an elderly parent that just can't be happy. And they don't know how to deal with that. They don't want to exclude them from the family gathering, but they want to make sure that, I don't know, it's a tough thing. I don't know what to tell them. But
yeah,
that's why you're here, because you're Dr. Judy O, and I'm not.
Well, I think part of this, again, the holidays, is that you just feel bad for excluding people. Mm-hmm. Like, you feel like you're supposed to include everybody. Again, holiday spirit, et cetera. I actually just dealt with this myself yesterday. I am hosting Thanksgiving, and one of my family members was like, hey, should we also invite so-and-so and their children, you know? And I was like, no, I'd really rather keep this the size that it is. And I said, hope you understand. And it's like, let's see them some other time. I feel like people just want to feel like they have to squeeze everything into just one big gathering. And then maybe you feel guilty, but, you know, and I felt a little guilty, but I also felt like, you know what, I want to be able to enjoy. And I'm not going to enjoy it so much if it's so big, or if you feel like there's going to be people there that may or may not actually contribute to it being a great get-together. So I think you just have to really ask yourself, like, is there an alternative? Because what I did was, I mean, first, I just basically said, no, thank you. And I didn't offer any alternative. And that's perfectly okay. But you can also offer an alternative, which actually I did a few minutes later, which is like, hey, let's make a plan to see them some other time, you know? But why does it have to be Thanksgiving, right? So I would encourage you to be more creative about, well, maybe not the big holiday dinner, but how about, you know, something else the weekend after or the weekend before? And it can just be something else where then you can manage your expectations and just focus on them.
This is an excellent text. This says, boy, we've got an introspective crowd today, Dr. Judy. This one says, how do I balance my own happiness with the happiness of somebody else?
Yeah, well, sometimes other people's happiness is related to our own. Obviously, we want the people we love to be happy, and sometimes seeing them happy makes us happy too. But I do think that there has to be some separation. Like, I also hear the opposite, right? Like, when somebody they love is upset, then all of a sudden they're having a horrible day. Maybe it's not completely easy to disengage from that feeling, but at the same time, you can't have it so that the boundaries between you and another person is just so mixed up that you can't really tell what's actually driving your happiness. So I do think that it's important to ask yourself, you know, what makes you happy? What do you really value? I love doing values inventory with people. It's because you get so caught up in thinking about what other people want and what people expect of you. And then you forget, you know, what are the things that I value most in this life? And it's really easy to do a values inventory. Just look it up online, type in values list or values card store, and you'll see a list of the most common values. And then just pick your top five. You know, what are the ones that are the most meaningful to me? And ask yourself every day, you know, am I doing something to honor at least some of these top values every single day. And that's how you find your core reason for meaningfulness and happiness. And then from there, of course you should care about other people being happy, but also you have to make sure that you're anchored in your own reasons for happiness first.
I got text here coming in from two different numbers back to back. Sometimes it happens. One of them says, the loneliness is driving me crazy, especially during the holiday season. Another one says, I don't mind being alone and people won't leave me alone. How do you talk about loneliness, holidays, dealing with it, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think loneliness is obviously, it's usually associated with it being it's a very negative feeling, right? It's like, I feel lonely and that's a bad thing. I'm not sure if the first person means that they feel lonely or if they just like being alone sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think that it's totally healthy to like being alone sometimes, as long as they don't feel bad about it. And I think that people probably maybe perceive that they're lonely and they're like, hey, I'm not. This is by choice. You know, I like it. Whereas I think if it's true loneliness, then it's actually having negative effects on your mental health and your physical health. And I don't know, Tommy, if you heard about those studies. I think they came out maybe 4 years ago, and it was about how feeling lonely chronically also essentially exposes you to higher risk of chronic health conditions and even early death. Mm-hmm. And then one metaphor they kept using was like, being chronically lonely is like smoking 15 cigarettes a day, which actually, by the way, is kind of misquoted, but it kind of took off and everybody was talking about it. But the message is actually true that people, you know, when you do feel lonely, it can lead to all these different issues. And so I think if it feels overwhelming for the person who texted about feeling lonely or struggling with that, it's not about having 100 best friends, right? It's about having a couple of really meaningful connections. That's much more important than having a huge crew of people or getting along with every single one of your family members. Like, if you have one or two that are your go-to people and you love them, I think that that's enough to get you out of that chronic loneliness. And so, you know, manage your expectations there too. You don't have to make a million best friends tomorrow to cure your own loneliness. This just starts with one or two really important connections.
This is a long text, and you can answer when we come back, and I'll try to wrap it up. Basically, the gist is the grown-up child's not coming into town for the holidays. Mom's okay with it, but Dad is very upset. Mom knows that the kid has a life of their own. Again, this is very long and complicated, but what I'm getting from this is that Mom's okay with it, or Dad's either way, one of them's okay with it, and the other one is not. We'll talk about, because then you got the problem of parents disagreeing on what the child should do, and you got the child not coming in for the holidays, blah, blah, blah. We'll talk about all that with Dr. Judy when we come back. Dr. Judy Ho, our guest, clinical licensed clinical neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books. Got any questions about holiday mental health, 504-260-1870. We'll talk more when we come back. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:47, 13 till 10. Talking to our friend, Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical neuropsychologist, forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, about holidays and stress and mental health. And somebody texted in, Dr. Judy, apparently Mom and Dad are upset, grown kids not coming in from out of town for Thanksgiving. One of them's okay with it because the kid's got a life and moved on. The other, not moved on, but, you know, it has their own life going on out of town. The other one's taking it very hard, so now there's a problem between the parents, and this is a whole thing that makes you think, can we just go to March and get all this behind us?
I know. I mean, it's kind of like full circle about how we talked about expectations at the very beginning of this conversation.
Let's just go to March Madness and basketball tournament, please, and put all this foolishness behind us.
Right? Can we? Yeah, no, but I totally get it, right? Because, you know, the holidays also makes you feel about, well, I mean, I think it makes you reflect on tradition for a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot. And so I think oftentimes parents are kind of thinking about the traditions they used to have and, you know, why are things changing, right? They have their own reasons for why they don't want those things to change, right? And they're kind of maybe thinking, well, this is the time I could count on my children coming to visit. And now I can't even count on that, you know? So I think obviously it makes so much sense that, you know, one of them would be struggling more than the other. Mm-hmm. But I think that the holidays are also a good time to release expectations and maybe to create some new traditions. And so you know, I mean, it's hard, you know, and maybe you want to take care of your family members' feelings. You can't do all of that. But it's also okay to say, well, maybe this is a year that we do it differently. And what are some things that we might look forward to or we might want to do and set something new up? You know, I think that it's not going to be easy, but it's also important to kind of grieve maybe a loss of a certain type of tradition that you expected. And then in its place, think about another tradition that might make you feel joy and make you feel like it's meaningful.
I am no licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, but I'll tell you this as the parent of a 28-year-old, and I'll tell you this too, young Judy Ho, that when that young man gets to be 28, he's going to have his own life. But you know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to go back and think, well, wait a minute. What was I like when I was 28? Did I really want to go out and hang out with the old man and the old lady, or did I want to do my own thing, right?
Good point. Mm-hmm. I want to hang out with my parents out a lot more now in my 40s than I did when I was in my 20s.
Exactly.
I'll tell you that much.
That's right.
So it always comes back around,
that's
Tommy.
Exactly.
It'll come around.
That's the point I'm trying to make with everybody. Somebody texted in. I don't want to get in a political jaunt here or anything, but somebody texted in about handling the stress, not because we talked about that yesterday with the manners guy in etiquette about conversations about politics and everything else, but just about people that are upset about the election, handling that stress. And I'm not saying that President Trump is bad, but there are some people that are upset. And just for people that are struggling with that, what would you tell them?
Well, I think that the feelings that people have had about this election are some of the strongest feelings that we've had about any election. So, like you said, you know, there are some people who are very unhappy with the choice and they can't move forward. Of course, why should they? It's only been a couple weeks, and also it's happening in present time, right? This is not something where people are like, hey, get over it. That was 20 years ago. It's like, oh no, this is actually happening and he's going to be president. And some people are very upset by that, or there are going to be some people who say, you know what, he might not be the best candidate, but I'm so sick of my family members talking smack about him. So it's obviously going to come up during the holidays, especially when you get together. It's kind of hard to avoid. And I think that for everybody's peace and happiness, there's no reason to try to have these conversations during holiday get-togethers. And if you're the host, you can do something about that much more proactively. You can say, hey, let's keep politics off the table just for today. I think that's a perfectly reasonable request of your guests. That doesn't mean that you're avoiding it. That doesn't mean that you're avoiding the elephant in the room. It's just like, look, we're probably not going to convince each other to think differently. And if this is going to rob us of our time together, you know, time is finite. We don't have just extended amounts of time. You never know when it's going to be the last time you get to see somebody or spend time with them. So I think we have to really just cherish that for what it is. And if your relationship with this person is more important than you being right about politics or trying to convince them otherwise, which you're not, most people, they're very ingrained for them. They're not going to change either. Then think about the reasons why that relationship is worth preserving and just put your pride aside and find something else to talk about.
Which brings us to the way I wanted to wrap this up, which is, you can't just tell somebody, look, be grateful for what you have, because that doesn't address what issues they have. However, we do, as individuals, can take a second to just think about everything that is on the positive side, right?
Exactly. I mean, practicing gratitude is important, right? And people sometimes are like, well, you know, that makes me feel like I'm just practicing toxic positivity. And that's not true. You know, it's not about saying that nothing bad is happening in your life, but it's about just appreciating the things that are going well. You know, that's really important for your mindset. It's also important because it helps you to be more kind towards other people, more empathetic. And that only radiates good things. You know, if you're able to have empathy for other people, it makes you feel a lot more at peace about something that you're in conflict about. And secondly, people feel that empathy from you, and they're going to appreciate that. And that's going to be something that they perhaps pay it forward, but at the very least, you've made a positive impact in another human being's life also.
Dr. Judy, thank you so much. Have a lovely Thanksgiving, you and your family, and just take it easy on yourself with the hostess duties. If I were you, given your level of success, I'd cater the entire thing. Just have it all catered to have them bring it in. You just be the charming host. You be the charming hostess that you are. That's all you got to do. Let somebody else do the catering, all right?
There we go. Thanks, Tommy. Happy Thanksgiving.
You
talk
too.
To you in a couple weeks.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, 9:54, 6 till 10, taking a break. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us on the other side here on WWL.